Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Alex Garland's Civil War is finally hitting theaters, and the writer-director joins us to discuss the new film.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune into the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 306 of Real Blend, a podcast that learned the hard way that the house always wins. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, and I am in Las Vegas for CinemaCon, which is why you can see I have a different backdrop, and I won for a little while, and then I lost. Right before coming on the show, I went over and played a little blackjack, and I went through a good amount of money in a very short amount of time.
Nice.
So,
I thought for a second there was like a Joker reference that I was like, does he play cards in the trailer? I don't
know. No, just me trying to play cards and being very there we go.
Where are you staying?
On this week's show, I'm in the Caesar's Palace, which is where the main CinemaCon stuff is happening. So
nice.
But Caesar's Palace, minimum bets. Very high. Not comfortable with that. Not comfortable at all. You don't get to play very long. On this week's show, Alex Garland's Civil War is finally hitting theaters. After a lot of hype for this film, we're going to give our spoiler-free reaction and then get into some more conversations about it. But more importantly than that, writer-director Alex Garland is joining us as our guest on this week's show. Truly honored to have him on to talk about this film. Joining me, as always, Gabe Kovach is in the producer's chair and filling in for Jake Hamilton, who's not with us today. Hi,
Sean,
Gabe,
I need a raise. I've been hosting like a month in a row now, I think.
This is really getting out of hand.
I'll have to talk to the Real Blend HR department. We'll get in touch with the CEO of this operation.
I blame the other guys for just being lazy. They're just like, we did 300 of these.
Yeah.
How many more do you really want at this point? Kevin McCarthy's still here, though. He's ready for Kev. The people in the comments were asking about you for the past two episodes, so you were missed by the Blackers.
I missed you guys, and I'm honored that Gabe got the first introduction today. I love that people are keeping tally of that. I think I'm still ahead at the moment. I believe.
Check the comments for the
Check the comments
down below. Yes.
Good to see you guys.
If you're checking the comments, that means that you're on the YouTube channel. You're watching the show. We thank you guys for coming by every week. Give us a like and a subscribe. Share the show with a movie-loving friend as well, too. If you're one of our audio listeners and you want to see the visual aspect of the show, go to youtube.com/realblendpodcast. And of course, as always, we have the Real Blend Premium, which gets you an ad-free version of the show. And a newsletter from myself you can sign up for. It'll arrive on Fridays with the new episode every other week. So check the description for information on where to sign up. Okay, so we've been talking about Civil War for a little while. The initial trailers for it hit and were, to me, a little jarring in terms of Alex Garland's hyper-realistic approach to what combat could look like on our shores. Like it was, but one thing I wasn't prepared for, which I thought that was very smart, and we'll talk about this when we get more into the review of the film, was choosing to tell his story from the perspective of boots on the ground, wartime journalists. And it was wartime journalists who happened to be covering a conflict that is set on America's shores.
Modern time.
And I was...
Right.
From the minute that I got a chance to see it at South by Southwest, I knew we wanted to get Alex on the show. And then the way that this kind of happens with scheduling, Jake had to bat solo for it. And so Kevin and I threw a bunch of questions at him. And I really appreciate that Jake was able to get Alex to get some time with Alex because we really wanted to have that on the show. So let's get right to our interview on behalf of Real Blend with Alex Garland for Civil War. And then we'll come out on the other side and the three of us will get a chance to talk about it because all three of us have seen it and have very strong thoughts on it. So without further ado, this is the wickedly talented and incredibly smart Alex Garland talking about his brand new film, Civil War.
There we go. All right. I know you have a hard out, so I'm going to jump into this. But seriously, thank you for taking the time. Welcome to the Real Blend podcast. We always brag, a filmmaker-driven podcast. So oftentimes the reason we created this show to begin with is because when we have a great film like this and a four-minute TV slot, sometimes it's difficult to get into some of the stuff that we really want to get into. But I want to start out talking about the decision to have Texas and California secede together. Mostly the reason I want to talk about it is because I know how much you've been asked about it over this press tour. So whenever you make a creative decision like that, do you do so knowing the way it's going to trigger people? Are you aware of how much people are going to want to talk about it? Or have you found yourself surprised over this press tour that that's been such a main focus for people?
No, I've been surprised. I think probably there are people who are really good at anticipating that response and understanding the way their film will play. You know, probably the greatest at that may be Spielberg, who's got a kind of supernatural ability to understand how the films he's working on will be seen and understood. I just don't have anything like that ability. So I make films really based on just, in the end, my own intuition. And the important thing for me is to not get too concerned about how things might get taken, because that can be sort of silencing. And to not trip yourself up, in a sense, knowing that you have a blind spot, keep walking, even though you might fall into a hole.
How often do you find yourselves, when you have to go on these press tours and talk about this film that you've poured so much of yourself into, do you find yourselves often having moments where you go, like, really, this is the thing you want to talk about?
Often.
Yeah. That's well, with this film in particular.
Yeah, very often. Partly because I'm aware that the film will be opaque in some ways, and so it leaves itself open to interpretation. And that is a deliberate thing, because I want it to be more like a conversation than a lecture. I'm interested in people's opinions and what they bring to it. Usually what they bring to it is a product of their own lived lives, you know, and all of that seems like a good thing. Often the thing that surprises me is that you get a kind of anger from some spaces that the thing is not being clear in the way they want it to be clear. And I sort of think, well, look, there's a lot of films that are super clear about everything. That's great. Why do they all have to be like that? I don't kind of get it. Often I think, in a way, the anger comes from, I wanted you to be clear about this in this way and you weren't, so I'm annoyed with you. That's what it, if you really reduce it, that's kind of what it says. And I sort of think, really? That's what you're angry about? Okay.
But in this film, there are a lot of answers buried and embedded in the film itself. I think it's just a matter of maybe rewatching it and listening to some of the things that people are saying. But I have to tell you, some of the dressing of the locations are absolutely incredible. The abandoned cars and the military equipment and sometimes just the desolation. I'm sort of curious of how much of a storyline you gave each set in the back of your mind, where you decide maybe what happened in that moment. And is there one set dressing in particular that was maybe more difficult than the others?
There's absolutely a storyline. Yeah. Yeah. For each one, for sure. The only one that slightly falls out of that category is in this weird winter wonderland. There's like a couple of snipers having a battle in a winter wonderland. And that was actually a set, quote unquote, that we found. It was all that abandoned Christmas stuff was simply abandoned in a field. And the farmer was kind of annoyed about it because someone had done this thing, gone bankrupt, and then just left all this winter wonderland stuff strewn around his field. And he was like, now I've got to pay to remove it. And we said, well, hang on, slow down. We'll pay to remove it. Just let us keep it for a little bit longer and we'll shoot on it. But apart from that, yes, everything is intentional. Everything has a story behind it. And, you know, sometimes you're working with people who want to know the exact story behind something, and other times people don't, and it just varies person to person and moment to moment.
Wow, that's honestly fascinating. I've got to tell you, I honestly think that one of the performances that hit me the most, hit me like a sledgehammer, and it's a testament to how little screen time he has, is Nick Offerman. I'm sort of curious, was there anything else filmed with the president, or was he always meant to sort of be this unseen, looming figure kind of over the story?
If anything, it was the opposite. We had 2 days with Nick. It was the first day of shooting and the last day of shooting, because I tend to shoot films in sequence. Mm-hmm. So following the story order as we go through the shoot. And the president was supposed to be a kind of fractured, distorted voice seen sometimes on fuzzy TV images as if they were digitally breaking apart, and often on radio stations there was like old-fashioned FM and you couldn't quite tune in and you could barely hear what he was saying. And then when we shot the first day, we just tried an experiment, which was like, okay, we've shot out this footage we need, but let's play with it a bit. And we started imagining, what if he was practicing the lines of the speech we're later going to hear? And there was just something so interesting about it. And that became the beginning of the film. It was never planned, but it actually worked really beautifully in various ways. There's a strange way in where you begin hearing this guy and almost immediately you stop trusting him. In some subtle way, you just stop trusting him. You can hear the sort of almost childish hyperbole of the way he's talking, the greatest history in the history of all military, or where just the sort of the raised temperature of it, but you can see him struggling to get there as well and fluffing it. And it set him up. It just set him up really beautifully.
Well, you know, so I feel like, I know there are a lot of unanswered questions in the film, but I feel like a lot of the answers come from subtle lines about the president, the fact that he's on his third term, the fact that he dismantled the FBI. I feel like the answers, while not spoon-fed to us, are there in a way because of him.
I'm very, very glad you say that. I feel they're there as well. I think it's partly because of my age. I've been doing this like quarter of a century working in this industry. And the period of time I started working, the received wisdom was you need to spoon feed everything. And in a way, the subtext of that was you need to treat the audience as if they're dumb. And it always felt weird to me. Not just me, by the way, there'd be lots of filmmakers who were fighting against that in one way or another. But sometimes it would be really, really difficult to fight against, sort of understandably, because film is a mass market form of entertainment. So it's not surprising it needs to homogenize itself and answer every question in a clear, explicable way. What I think is, audience, I really mean this, I do not think audiences are stupid. I think they are interested in questions, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them. And if you make the thing for the right price, so if I'd made this, obviously no one would have given me the money, but if I had made this for $300 million, clearly that would be a dumb thing to do. But if you find a partner like A24 who thinks 50 is a reasonable risk to take for what the film is, then suddenly it kind of makes sense. And to me, what A24 demonstrated to a lot of the legacy studios is that audiences are broader and more interested in risk-taking than they were traditionally perceived to have.
In terms of, asking the questions, though, I do have to confess to you, and this is a testament, I think, to all the films you've directed, that whenever they cut to black, go to the credits, or in this case, cut to white, I'm often left going, okay, well, what happens next? I want to know, like, what is in the next day or week or month to come. When it comes to this film in particular, or I guess any film in your filmography, how much do you decide what comes next? Is the story over when the movie cuts to credits, or do you really sort of plan it out in your head?
That's a really good question. I've never had that question, I think. I think I stop thinking about it and I have a hunch, but I don't really follow it through. So if you were to ask me what happens next in this film, I would probably start making something up on the spot and pretending I already knew. Then again, you did just ask me. I didn't do that. So
it's less of wanting you to tell me because I kind of want to decide for myself. But I'm curious as to if you have the answers.
No, but I'll tell you what I think is that the way I make films is deliberately attempting to include what the audience thinks. What, not the audience as a mass, but the individual viewer. I'm not trying to freeze them out. I'm actually trying to do the opposite. And when somebody has an interpretation of a moment that is not my interpretation, however sort of strange or sort of unlikely this sounds, I don't see it as being less valid than my interpretation. Sometimes I might think, well, I'm not sure how you got there because there is this bit of information and that bit of information. It would lead you, I think, to a different conclusion. But I understand that when you tell someone a story, you are telling it to an individual that has their own worldview and their own life experience, and they will shape that story and receive that story in accordance with those things. And I not only don't mind that, I kind of like it. I mean, look, if somebody was to draw an inference from the film and say, I think this is a sort of pro-racist treaty about why we should nuke the world, right? I'd sort of think, okay, hang on a minute. This has probably gone a bit too far. But
yeah, you watched a different movie.
Right. You would, yeah. And but also what I would think is that is not so much about me or the film. That is about you. That is about the things you have brought into this. And I think that tends to be the case. And I don't like it's not fun if somebody gives a very uncharitable interpretation of it, but I sort of at the same time in a weird way respect it. And if it's a sort of well-meaning interpretation that just happens to be their own, then I actually kind of like it. So it's sort of I'm not sure I've explained that very well, but
no, I completely get what you're talking about. I want to talk about what I think is one of your secret weapons, and oftentimes when he's cast in the right role, anyone's secret weapon, which is the great Stephen McKinley Henderson. And there is a shot of him that gives me chills. I've seen the film twice, and it's following a needle drop. There is a shot of Stephen looking into the camera as he's watching and kind of processing something awful that's happening in front of him. And I feel like you get so many things out of him in this film, but that shot in particular gave me chills for some reason. Can you talk about utilizing an actor like that, all the different talents that he is able to bring? Because we have those quiet, still moments, and then we have the screaming of getting the effing car. Like, I feel like you're able to utilize so much from him in his screen time.
I think that there's two baseline things with Stephen. I think one of them is that he's just a very good actor. Mm-hmm. It sounds like an obvious thing to say, but the truth is, if you give a line to Stephen, he will elevate that line. It will be a better line at the end of it coming out of his mouth. He will just do stuff. He's also, as an individual, he's highly intelligent. He's kind, and sometimes he can be spiky, and he can be kind of tough in a gentle way, but very tough. But underneath it, he's really highly, highly intelligent. And what I think is that when he lets that off the leash, when he lets you see it, all of that just arrives in the character. So in that moment, you talk about that shot. What you see is someone is his expression. It has a kind of severity to it, but also he's not blinking. He's not looking away. He is recording this thing. He knows that's what he needs to do, and he's taking it seriously, and he's somehow taking it all in. You feel like he's taking everything in of this moment of horror that's happening in front of him. And what does Stephen bring? That's what he brings.
That's honestly, it's one of my favorite. I know there are wildly far more complicated shots in the film, but I don't know why. That's one of probably top five favorite shots in the film.
Do you know something? The DOP I almost always work with is a guy called Rob Hardy. And at the end of films, he'll always say, that's my favorite shot. And it always surprises me. Almost always, maybe always, it's not a big landscape shot. It's not a complicated crane shot. It'll be quite a simple shot of someone's face. I remember in this TV show we did together called Devs, which is 8 episodes and really has a lot of photography in it from start to finish. His favorite shot was a Sonoya Mizuno sitting at a kitchen table in a tight close-up. And I think it's because what cinematography is often there to do is really beholden to the actor. And if it is perfectly capturing the thing that the actor is offering up, a lot of DOPs are very satisfied by that. And in basically the way you said, because that's sort of all our job on a film really is just to capture the drama. You know?
Yeah. When a shot says everything that a line, you know, could, I would love to talk about, whenever I had the pleasure of speaking with Kirsten Dunst at the Junket, she told me, and maybe this was a joke or the way she was phrasing it, but she said that Jesse Plemons took his part in the film as a favor to her, and obviously paid off because that scene is honestly one of the most tense sequences I think I've seen it in a very long time. I'd love to know the story of how he became involved in the movie. And if their personal relationship off camera at all affected the scene on camera.
Well, I don't know. I literally don't know about the way it would have informed the scene. But what happened was there was another actor who was going to do that part. And around about a week before we started shooting, because we were in the rehearsal period, for various reasons, that actor just had to drop out. And I was really worried because that scene is kind of a pivot point in the film. And it contains a lot of really important information in the film, actually. And I was pretty despondent. I was standing outside this tower block and took the call outside and then thought, well, I better go in for the rehearsal. But inside I had a kind of hollow, empty, worried feeling. Like, oh boy, we're in big trouble now. And got the elevator up, went into the place that we were rehearsing and thought I should tell the cast this immediately because it's the right thing to do. And Kirsten immediately said, I bet Jesse would do it. Let me find out. And 24 hours later, Jesse said, yeah, I'll do it. Read the script. And so it was a huge result, huge.
Yep. It was unbelievable. It's 10 minute sequence, but it's one of my favorite performances of the year.
He's pretty stunning.
Yeah.
It's a great bunch of acting, a great bunch of actors, excuse me. But that thing he does, arrive, encapsulate something, leave, film loves that. And it wasn't exactly a pleasure to shoot that scene, but it was like a masterclass. It was very, very impressive to watch. All of them together joined him in the tension of that moment. All of them, really.
You're right. It's definitely an ensemble moment for sure. It doesn't work unless they're all there given 100%. This might be a stupid question. The story of you announcing your retirement got, as they tend to do on the internet, got blown out of proportion, I feel like, a bit. Correct me if I'm wrong. I know you're going to take a break from directing, but there was a moment when a lot of people...
I never announced my
retirement. Right, yeah.
What I did, I said I'm going to take a break from directing for the foreseeable future, which is just simply not the same statement as I retire. But anyway, yeah, go on.
There's no room for subtlety on the internet.
It's not even subtle. I thought for the foreseeable future, it's not a nuanced statement. It's pretty straightforward. But anyway, sure, go ahead. Yeah.
But I guess the point of my question was, in that period of moment, in that period of time, before the quote was clarified or understood in terms of what it was originally said, there was an outpouring of appreciation and love for your work. There's a lot of people saying when they thought you were going to retire, I don't want him to retire because he's an incredible filmmaker. And I'm just sort of curious as if you caught any of that, and if you were received any of the while it was, you know, a misunderstood quote, if you at least received the positivity of people going, oh, it really sucks that this guy's going to retire because I do love him as a director.
I didn't, but that's very nice. I would have expected maybe it would be like, okay, bye. That's nice to hear. I was not aware of that, though.
It was sort of the what's the Robert Duvall film where he has the funeral for himself so he can hear what people say about him. It was sort of the equivalent of like getting to hear all the nice things that people say about you.
Yeah, that happens in. It sort of happens in Curb Your Enthusiasm, and it also happens in Tom Sawyer. I think it's Tom Sawyer. There's a sort of it's a fantasy people have, isn't it, to hear the eulogy, but at the same time, be careful what you wish for, because who knows what people will say.
Very true. This is not meant to be one of my questions, but did you watch the Curb finale last night?
I did not.
I won't ruin it for you.
I'm halfway through that season, but I'm a big fan. My younger brother thinks, God, I really shouldn't say this, but he thinks I'm very like Larry David. And sometimes when I walk into a room, he does the theme tune music as I walk in.
That's fantastic. I'd love to ask, this is a strange question, but obviously in addition to directing some amazing films that we all love, you've written a lot of incredible work that you never actually directed yourself. Is there a scene that you wrote that someone else directed? Not saying that you would do better than them, but what's a scene that you didn't get to direct that you wrote? That a part of you as a filmmaker now looks at it and goes, you know, it would have been cool to have been behind the camera for that one.
Huh. I can give a scene that I wrote that the director improved beyond all recognition. The start of 28 Days Later has Cillian Murphy's character waking up and walking through deserted London. And if I remember right in the script, that was like two paragraphs. And what Danny did was build it out into like a, I don't know, 5 minute, 6 minute sequence or whatever it is. And I remember learning something at the time, because that was the first time I'd written a script and then had it, you know, and then it got turned into a film. Understanding something about what a director does, and sort of when they're good at any rate. So that, is that in terms of a film, a scene that I'd written that I wished I'd directed, I honestly can't think of one, but so I'll give you a different sort of example. Sometimes I do think people misunderstand directing a lot. I think directors are often given more credit than they deserve at the expense of the other people in the film, which could be actors, but also very much could be crew. It's not a coincidence that production designers and DOPs and costume people get fought over, and lots of people are trying to hire the same people. It's because they're really doing something. They're really bringing something. And I feel directors are usually over credited in terms of what they bring, but they do bring something. They do something, and what they bring can be very important. I think that was a good example of me learning what a really good director does, and Danny is certainly a good director.
You're absolutely right. It's apples and oranges, but whenever we have interns here at my news station, I always say, okay, that's great. You want to be a reporter. You want to be in front of the camera. That's great. You need to go sit with the editors for a week. You need to go out with the photographers for 2 weeks. You need to sit down with the writers. Like you can't do your job well unless you're understanding, I think, what other people are doing.
You can't, and it's particularly true because there's lots of jobs. So the one you're doing now or directing, in a way, go out of their way to hide the fact that there's a duck sliding along the surface of the water, but their feet are furiously paddling underneath. It's a deliberate obfuscation. Film, it is particularly true. It's not just that; it's to do with the way they're sold. So you don't see a film that says from the production designer of, it always says from the director of, because it's easy. It's an easier way to market something. But if you look at individual directors and you think, God, this film is, their films are really changing film to film. There's no common tone, or the tone is veering all over the place. If you then look to the people behind it, you often find an answer to that question. It's not to negate the importance of director, it's just to reframe it slightly.
For sure. I'm going to cut you loose on this because I know you have a hard out, but you mentioned 28 Days Later, and there are a lot of us who are incredibly excited about the concept of 28 Years Later. But, you know, that's such an incredible story, such an incredible character that Killian brought to life. I'm just sort of curious what you think the concept of time is going to do with that story and that character. What are years going to do that's going to make that story interesting?
That's partly what the film is about. Is exactly that, is it's to do with the passage of time and thinking about what effect the passage of time would have. And is it what you would traditionally call a post-apocalyptic state, or has something else begun to manifest? Or it's time is really at the core of the engine of the film.
Well, we're dying to see it, but until that day, I cannot recommend this film enough. I like I said, I've seen it twice, saw it on the big screen here in Chicago, and then the studio was kind enough to send me a link to watch it one more time to be able to prepare for all the interviews and everything. But incredible film, and seriously, thank you for an incredible conversation, sir. I really do appreciate your time.
I appreciate you and your questions. Thank you very much indeed.
Good to see you again, sir. Take care. Hope to see you again soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We want to thank our good friends at A24 and, of course, Alex Garland for joining us on the show. Okay, we're going to get into a review of the new film Civil War. This initial phase is going to be without any kind of spoilers. We'll keep it to conversations of things that are shown in the trailer and just our gut reactions to it. Kevin, I haven't really sat down and talked with you in depth since you got a chance to see it. I saw it before you and kind of weighed in on the text thread. But where are you at with it? I'm very curious on how this movie affected you and how you still feel about it, thinking about it later.
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that I feel is relentlessly, immersively brutal in such a way that is that you physically feel it. This is a movie you feel and just have to decompress and think about a lot afterwards. I was texting you guys. I felt ill when the movie ended. I think Gabe said he felt a similar way. It's very shocking. It is a very mean film, and just in terms of just like I mean, maybe the wrong word, but maybe like it's just in your face.
Aggressive.
Aggressive would be the word.
Yeah.
And I think what's fascinating about it is the performance perspective of it, but also just the way I thought the way Garland used music was fascinating. When you watch the film, you're going to have these juxtaposed moments of horrific, disturbing violence, then juxtaposed with this upbeat style music that just kind of takes you on, carries you on throughout the film. And he talks a little bit about how he had to justify those moments and kind of how you take a war picture and add in music that may be a more upbeat style, but it's definitely trying to comment on it. Or I felt it was trying to almost calm the audience down in a way during certain sequences. But I loved so much of it from a technical perspective, but also a performance perspective. I was very intrigued by the way that Kirsten Dunst and Kaylee Spaney held their cameras, the way their cameras were their guns in a way, right? The way they would go into a moment and kind of how they were following along with the action. It was their way of viewing it. And the picture was, the bullet in a way where hopefully that has an impact on people who then see it. And I think it's interesting because like there's this quote in the film that I thought was fascinating, which was, "We record so people ask." And I think the movie is designed as a journalist, for me, particularly seeing the film, the movie poses so many questions that I then wanted to ask about as a journalist. So it was like weird talking to the cast from that perspective, because I'm then asking questions about what they recorded.
True.
And it's really interesting. And I think, to think that this is Garland directed his first movie 10 years ago, Ex Machina. And then he does Annihilation, obviously Men, and then now this. But the writing he had done prior was extraordinary. 28 Days Later, 28 Weeks Later, Did You Never Let Me Go? In Sunshine.
Beach?
Yeah, I
he
think
the beach with Danny Boyle.
I know Sunshine for sure. Double check on the beach. I don't know.
Did he write the book?
Maybe Story?
Based on?
Yeah. Okay. But I know for sure he wrote the screenplay, I think, for Sunshine as well.
Yes, he wrote the novel, The Beach. I don't know if he wrote the screenplay, but he wrote the novel that it's based on.
Did he really?
Okay. Yeah.
You know, the first scene that comes to mind when I think of it at the beach is like when he goes up and he sees all the weed, all the marijuana.
That was a movie that I saw at a perfect age, like teenager way into movies. And it like kind of blew my mind. Like it like opened up this, it's unlocked this new DiCaprio, like in my mind. I was like, this is amazing. Yeah.
I got to revisit that movie. I haven't seen it in forever. And I'm sure it's really interesting from a Garland and Danny Boyle perspective. So I'm going to throw that on sometime soon.
I'm with Gabe. That movie kind of hit a certain time. But back to Civil War. I mean, this is the for people who aren't super familiar with it, you're basically following these journalists from New York to Washington, D.C. As the rebel forces are descending on the White House. And Nick Offerman, the way the film opens is just so fascinating, the way they chose the lenses and the way they wanted to portray it. But I thought it was really cool the way Alex decided then to show us the pictures that the journalists are taking. As you go throughout the film, Kaylee and Kirsten are they're war photographers, and Kaylee's kind of, she's new to the game. She looks up to Kirsten Dunst's character.
Yeah, like a mentor student relationship.
Yeah,
which I really connected with.
Which I thought was cool because Kaylee's shooting film and Kirsten shooting digital.
Oh, really?
And you have the new school journalist shooting the old school format and Kirsten shooting, a newer format, a digital format in a way. And I found that to be a really interesting commentary. And I won't go into spoilers, but there's a really interesting payoff in how they deal with these pictures throughout the film.
Can I give you this is just kind of a cool detail thing. And I'm not usually like a pick apart nerdy detail, type of viewer. But when she was developing the film, I was lucky enough to be in school when we were still developing film and had like a dark room and all that stuff. So I was like, ooh, like I saw her doing it. And I was like, all right, let's see. I was like, now let's see how they do this. And if I can tell you that she nailed the way that you turn the canister perfectly, because you kind of give it a little give. You're not trying to form any bubbles. I was like, hell yes. I was like,
really funny.
Yeah, it was so good.
And her shooting film is a huge thematic in the film, obviously. And so I'll just kind of end by saying that this is one of the more immersively disturbing experiences I've ever had in a theater. Will I ever see it again? I don't know. Is it necessary for people to see? I would say it's an important film. I think the commentary is something that you can decide on how you want to react to it, how you want to see it. They talk about, I think in press, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's nonpartisan and they're the film is trying to essentially record and then have you ask the questions. Sure. And I think it's a fascinating look. What scares me the most about it is how timely the picture is. Obviously, within our country right now, we know that we're very divided. And that's just a fact. We are a divided nation. And I think that the movie picks on an aspect of things that you could potentially be worried about in the future. Sure. And that is genuinely scary because, as we talked about prior to recording the show, the imagery that you're seeing, and this is in the trailer, like in the helicopters flying around DC at night and all the freaking guns, and it's just terrifying. But I think it's a necessary film. And I personally, out of Alex's work, I think this is a film that I can feel his voice more through this movie than I can through his other films. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is something about it. I also think it's really cool. I was thinking about this the other day. I didn't think about this. Most of his films are female led, which I really love. Ex Machina, Alicia Vikander's character, she's really the star and the lead of that movie. Annihilation, a group of women, incredible actors. The movie Men, obviously, what he's talking about there. Jesse and then Buckley. Here, following these characters. And I want to shout out Wagner Morab, who's phenomenal in the film as well. He's the character that essentially is driving.
I was so excited to see him.
Yeah.
The part that I want to emphasize is how apolitical the movie is. And I had an initial concern of myself personally, having seen the trailer. I kind of had a reaction that I'm hearing from a lot of people is that we don't need this movie right now because our political climate is so divisive. So why would you put a movie in here that's essentially taking sides? And what blew me away the most about it is how much it goes out of its way to almost not take sides.
And, oh, it doesn't.
Yeah. And I just don't know if people are going to pick up on that based on the marketing, because, you know, you can almost instantly sort of put your own spin on what you see. But and Kev, one of the things you were talking about, too, which is so tough about the film, is to see actual conflict in places that are intimately familiar to us. Mm. And we have a global audience. You know, we hear from people all around the world. And in a way, we're lucky in the sense that we haven't had to experience that. But how many people listening to Real Blend can unfortunately identify with the fact that they've maybe seen, you know, combat taking place in places that are too close to their home? So that's a reality that I think a lot of people listening to this might be dealing with. And we just are just seeing it for the first time in a movie like this. And it's memorable. It really sticks with you.
Real quick, because I want you to continue. But what's interesting about what you just said is we've seen imagery like this before in movies, but not set to this tone, like White House Down and Olympus Has Fallen. We've seen movies that have put fight and
sensational action-y, glamorous type.
Yep.
And, fun movies. Yeah.
But and you're right. Like Olympus Has Fallen was like Die Hard basically in the White House. So it's like, and I find that, I just wanted to point that out because it is interesting. We've seen imagery kind of like this before, but when you see it in the tone that Alex has set this in, it's so more, it's like when I watch Olympus Has Fallen, I don't think about that happening, but I do when I'm watching Civil War, I'm going, I live in DC. I work. Yeah. I mean, I remember that, you know, I mean, I won't get political, but there's things that have happened in my time here in DC that have been scary. And you do think about that when you're watching something like this.
But the tone that I think that Alex gets incredibly correct, is the idea of the journalistic community. And I can only speak to my own experiences. I'm not a wartime reporter by any way, stretch or form. But there are aspects of the journalists when they gather at the end of the day in a bar to trade war stories or, you know, rip on each other for their outlets kind of thing in a playful sort of way that he just gets. And there was a line that Kirsten Dunst has when she's like, I'm just going to go upload my footage and pass out. And like, I can't tell you how many times that like, we have said something like that at a Comic-Con, you know, of just like, hey, do you want to go to this next place? No, I'm literally just going to go back and upload what someone's waiting for, you know, currently at the moment.
And then scoops. Crash. Like there was a whole scoop bit about where they were like, scoop might be the wrong word to use in this terminology, but like, the journalists weren't sharing information about what they had. And it's,
they're very candid in the fact that like they are trying to get to Washington to interview the president. Right. It's kind of top of mind of like, well, he might not even be there by the time we get to Washington. And it's, you know, interesting for us where in a deadline basis, you know, that we're always having these conversations about like, are we going to get this done in time? Not trying to compare movie journalism at all to what's happening in Civil War. But a lot of those journalistic aspects I thought were really relevant. I also can't say enough about Kaylee Spiney. Kaylee Spiney. I loved her in Priscilla. That's legitimately one of the first times that I have noticed her. I know she's been in a couple of different things other than that, but the way that Sofia Coppola brought out of her this really complicated position that Priscilla Presley was in, having to deal with Elvis's fame when he's away from Graceland and be his safety net anytime he came back, and how she wrestled with those, I thought was phenomenal. And then it was really funny in the junket because the three of them were paired. And I asked Kirsten, like, who was a mentor for her sort of thing. And she starts talking about her early days with Sofia Coppola. Mm. And I was like, God, the influence of Sofia Coppola on these two women has been incredible. I think Kaylee Spaney is going to be a massive force for people to, because it's her arc, essentially, you know, like she shows up as the young pup who wants to get involved. They're kind of keeping her at arm's length to protect her. And she becomes our surrogate because we want her to succeed, but we want her to be safe, you know, and how much do we want her to sort of learn on the job sort of thing. And her evolution throughout the course of it is both, you know, terrifying and but strangely inspirational, you know, because it's like we do need these people, that we do need these journalists on the front line, you know, who are ready to cover the story and sort of do what it takes to tell the stories that need to be told. So I was really, really impressed with the decision to tell the story through that front line. So I need to see it again. Currently, I think it's my number one movie of the year. I mean, it's super early. It's almost April.
Sure.
It's April. But it's going to be in the conversation for me for a long time for top 10. Gabe, where are you at with it?
I think I've seen it most recently. I saw it on Monday. We're recording on Wednesday. So it's still fresh and I still feel like I'm unpacking it in a lot of ways. Yeah. I love having conversations with you guys because you unlock some of those thoughts. I could honestly parrot, I think, pretty much everything you guys said about it being incredible. And I think that like that word is used to talk about the level of which it achieves and not that it's the most entertaining, fun watch, incredible.
Right. Sure.
And I, you know, Kevin talked about feeling sick afterwards. And I did say, I was like, I think I described it afterwards. Like I feel a little sick to my stomach, but I have no regrets having seen it. Like I'm in awe of it. It makes you kind of feel a pit in your stomach. But in this really graceful way, as it were. I agree. I think Kaylee's fantastic. I think the whole cast is amazing in it. We get the ever elusive cameo from
Jesse Plemons.
And it's such a Jesse Plemons cameo in the best way. I don't think you guys have heard it yet because Jake was the one that covered it, but we get some of the behind the scenes story about how Jesse Plemons became involved in the interview, and he talks about how he kind of did it as a they had an actor that had to drop out, and so he kind of came in last minute.
Like a favor. Oh, you're kidding me, really?
As a favor for Kirsten, yeah.
For Kirsten.
Holy cow, because he's so incredible.
Right, right. And it was literally a favor. She said it was a favor.
Yeah, they sent him the script, and he was like, yeah, I'll do it.
He is so talented, man. That's crazy.
People listening to this, you can get a clip of this moment in the trailer. But the way that this sequence plays out, the sustainability of the intensity is so unnerving. Ooh. I felt my skin crawling during that sequence.
Talk about how rare it is to create a terrifying scene in broad daylight.
It's impossible sometimes to do something like that.
And Kevin, I'd be curious if you had conversations in your interviews about this, but one thing that I found myself, sometimes you watch a movie and you go, man, I wish I could ask them this question or something that really sticks out. And I'm really curious to hear him and his cinematographer's process on the still photography and sort of how much of that was intuitive versus how much of that was really, how much thought went into that and how different it was to stage a scene to be cinematic and striking but it also needing to offer an angle that is striking, but candid and realistic, you know, like there's realism in the cinema, but it's still cinematic. Yeah. It's still elevated to that level. But those moments that you see those images, they feel very real, and they had to make these moments happen so that they could capture it that way. I'm really curious about the mechanics of that.
I did ask, and I'll be vague. So one of the things I was curious about was whether or not the photos that we're seeing on screen are the real photos taken by the actors. And from what I'm referring to is as the movie continues, as Kirsten and Kaylee are taking the pictures, Alex chooses very specific moments where he cuts to their images. There is a sequence, which I won't say where it is or what happens in the sequence, where Kaylee is photographing a very intense moment in the film. And because of the logistics of her film camera, Alex told me that they couldn't get the lighting right to actually have her camera take the image, but he wanted Kaylee to direct where the images were going. So in this particular sequence, they basically attached Kaylee to the camera operator physically, and she physically moved him around and told him when to shoot. So this guy, Alex told me, was half... Kaylee was half his size, so she's literally like, so basically in the sequence, which you'll see in the film later on, those images are directed essentially by Kaylee, and to Gabe's point, she's telling the camera operator when to capture it. So to your point, it's directed by her. She chose how it was going to be.
That is fascinating, but I also more mean the actual blocking of the scene. Cause like there are, and I don't even need to get specific about what happens, but like there are scenes where in the movie, this scene is unfolding and there's action involved with it. There's violence involved with it. and it's pushing the story forward. We're learning about these characters. It's very much important to the film, but it also provides these moments for still photography that looks ripped right out of the front page. You know, yeah. some of the best, it really hits that striking level that you only get with someone who is there. Because a photojournalist is really fascinating, because a photojournalist is a journalist and they're looking for information and they're looking for stories, but they're also photographers and they're artists and they're looking for the image that is going to be striking so that it gets your attention so that you look at the story.
Which is a theme in the movie. Exactly. There's a whole arc to that moment.
I'd be really curious to hear him talk about you're writing these scenes and you're staging these for a cinema camera. But at what point do you start to go, okay, here's where we need the photojournalist to be to capture, you know, this image, and here's why it's striking, you know, because they all hit. There's no like there are good and bad photos. They explore the.
So you think they're planned in advance? You think the stills are planned?
Certainly, I think devised. I would just love to hear them talk about their process of how they got there.
Yeah. Well, some of the photos you're seeing in the movie are actually taken by the actors, and some of them are not.
Because for instance, to get specific, and it doesn't have to be necessarily like there's moments where like, okay, someone's been shot, they're dying, this is happening, it's all unfolding. But they get an image of it and they knew they were going to get an image of it, but there's the action and the way the hands are and everything is very particular in that image. And I would just love to hear how those conversations went, or if it was kind of find it in the moment, which is photojournalism. Like it's
sure.
You're in charge of just finding it in the moment.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. I mean,
if we can, I want to just now shift to spoilers, because there are a couple of scenes particularly that I would like for us to transition
spoiler
to.
Spoiler warning. Beep, 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 beep.
Alarms spoiler warning off. is now up. And there are three scenes that help make this movie my number one. And I think that they speak a lot to...
Dune came out this year, right? Sure.
No, I know. I understand. I understand. And I think they speak to where we are, because I think very much the movie can talk about any combat at any time, in any place. Like the themes of the photographer is still going to apply no matter where you set this. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I think Alex went out of his way to comment on is the people who approach conflict by ignoring it, by burying their heads in the sand. And I thought that detour to the town that was ignoring the conflict just gutted me. Like that was such a, for two reasons, because of two things that happened in it. A, the town existing on its own was surreal after sitting through the amount of sort of conflict and the unbelievably exquisite production value that shows you, you know, like just a shot of them going down a highway that's littered with stranded cars. Mm-hmm. And you think to yourself, like, well, what happened here? And why is this area like this now? Mm-hmm. To then arrive at a quote unquote pristine Americana town where the people just admit, like, no, we're not participating. But then to go the one step further and to have those journalists like stop and try on clothes and almost remember like what normal quote unquote life was that for some reason hit me so hard.
The commentary in the middle of the country, right?
Well, the commentary in the middle of the country, but like the story really is the sort of passing ships of Haley's character and Kirsten Dunst's character. And that's kind of a moment for Dunst to be like, oh, she's starting to get in touch with what reality really is, because she's been embedded for, you know, decades really in these sort of things. And I thought that I agree with you. I thought that was that kind of perfect moment for her to have a touch of that as we see them sort of cross paths in her sort of become disillusioned by it, losing faith in it, and Kaylee's character rushing in head first, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that scene was pivotal, you know, to include it in that added so much more depth to their characters. And I thought it was a really necessary pit stop. The second one was when you got to see the extent of the California, Texas militia when they ascended. Yeah. And this to me felt like you would almost see this in a movie like Platoon or Apocalypse Now, where the military and the troops are sort of like airlifting off of a location. And it's the first time that you hear that the Western forces. You hear that they're coming to Washington. But when I first got to see the scope of what was coming that way, that's when I was like, holy shit,
I saw this in IMAX.
This is real.
I saw this in IMAX, and the sound design in this put Nolan to shame as far as the just how intense every shot was.
Like, remember the beginning with the sound of like the TVs? Did you hear that in IMAX?
Yes. It was back and forth all over. That was cool.
So cool.
I think it's, you know, I wanted to ask, because you bring up the platoons in the Apocalypse Now. Has there ever really been an anti-war movie that was like this, but set in the future, but not like a, you know, oh, it's Star Wars is anti-war, but it's also like, you know, a million other things. And it's kind of under the surface, whereas this feels like it's Apocalypse Now, but it's shifting ahead versus, you know, all these anti-war movies that tell us these stories that have already happened. I thought that's kind of fascinating.
Maybe. Yeah. I can't think of one that seems to be reacting so close to the climate that we're in. You know, like even those movies when they arrived, you know, post Vietnam, enough time had passed,
right,
that you weren't commenting on a reality or a situation that almost feels like it could still be coming almost thing.
And so, one thing that's on the anti-war nature of it, because you guys talked about the, like, politically it not picking a side and trying to be apolitical, because I think truly it feels scary based on the trailer. People like, why have this now? Because you're just kind of worried, I guess, about the reaction, or just in general, it just be feeling too real.
Sure.
But I commend the film for really punching home that it's about humanity and it's about the importance of human life and what's at stake. And I'm a sucker for whenever, you know, it's sort of like when the movie says the name and it's like, they said the name of the movie, you know, but when they say the thing that the movie's about, you know, in the movie, when she talks about trying to send, she thought that she was sending these images home as a warning not to do this here. And this movie is very much that. It's a don't do this here. Whatever the division is, whatever the differences are, taking it this far is never going to be worth it because you lose so much.
Sure.
And I thought was such a beautiful, beautiful way for it to handle its messaging with while dodging the sort of political nature of it.
So, and then the last thing I want to bring up is just the final 15 minutes. But I want to frame it in this sense. So if you're listening to this, you've hopefully seen the movie and you understand that this is like the siege on the White House, and this is the
scene that I'm talking about in our non-spoiler discussion with Kaylee Spaney.
Sure.
This is the White House sequence is where she's attached, and that's where they're getting the images. Yeah. Cool.
That's crazy. I want to it is technically it's brilliant. You know, it's one of those situations where you're watching it and you have to be asking yourself, how did he just not like stage the siege of Washington, D.C.
right.
and capture it? It looks that realistic.
It looks great.
And to have, you know, this sort of precision military bit where, you know, tap the shoulder, you're going this way, I'm going that way. But you're in a decimated White House is, again, that unnerving, like, how can this happen here? But I want to ask it from this perspective because I've played Call of Duty a couple of times.
Sure, sure.
And I don't understand why it's cathartic to play, you know, a mission like that. And yet when you watch it play out in a movie, it's disturbing. I don't, maybe I'm getting too psychological.
I think I know kind of what you're getting at. And I would say maybe the difference is the suspension of disbelief. This movie doesn't really want you to suspend your disbelief, or at least it doesn't suspend your disbelief that much, you know, like, whereas even if it's in Call of Duty, to your point, has been called out for kind of some of its ultra realism and getting a little too close to home and kind of that is its whole thing on itself. But I think a lot of the defense of it or the difference rather in what you're talking about is that suspension of disbelief. And I'm playing a video game and I'm clicking, you know, it's Pong, but it's Pong looks a little different, like I'm trying to hit the ball to hit this paddle basically. Whereas the film, I think, is very deliberately, and just by the fact of when it's set and how it plays out, it's unnerving because it looks real. Like it just looks like this is what it would look like if this happened tomorrow.
And to Gabe's point, and I know I ask this question a lot, that is also part of the reason why the aspect ratio is the way it is. He wanted it to look like you were watching real news footage. And he said, like, because if you look at his earlier films, like Ex Machina and Annihilation are like 239, 235, and then Men was 185, and this is 185. 185, I remember Spielberg saying that 185 was the truth. It's kind of like more about, and I interpreted that, and Alex, when I told Alex that, he interpreted that more of like the way our eyes see. What is the lens that's closest to the way our eyes see? And he says, because you're referencing real life in this movie and you're referencing news footage and things like that, the ratio is taller and full. So because it's meant to be kind of how you view the world in a way. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but that's kind of, he gave a really interesting answer about the narrative reasoning as to why this is such a taller frame. And it's supposed to make you feel like you're watching real life, essentially, is what I interpreted by his answer.
Kev, I want you in this moment, before we come out of spoilers and wrap this up, the scene that took you out of it briefly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and again, I love this movie. I'm at a 4.5 out of 5 for my review. My biggest problem with the film is the entire movie feels extremely dangerous to me. It feels, the way I'm equating it is this: if you go to the bowling alley and go bowling and you put bumpers up, you're pretty much safeguarded to know that your ball is going to hit some pins and you're fine. This entire film feels like you're off rails. There's no safety. You don't know where that ball is going to go. It could do anything. And this is A24. This is, you know, while they are a big Hollywood studio, but they're not at the same time.
Right.
And so
they're still the cool kids at the table.
Right. but when I was watching Civil War, I was scared as to where the movie was going. I didn't feel safe at all. I didn't feel like this was going to be bumper cars. This was real life accidents and car crashes. Sure. So the entire film didn't feel Hollywood to me whatsoever. There's an arc that happens with Kaylee Spaney's character and Kirsten Dunst's character, which I understand narratively. But the way Kirsten Dunst's character dies, the way that is shot, I think I remember it being slowed down. Gabe, you saw it recently. It felt extremely melodramatic.
Interesting. Like
I think, to me, and Sean and I discussed this on text as well, having Kirsten's character either die in the crossfire and then Kaylee gets the image, that makes more sense to me. The way it was done just felt like a Hollywood moment. It felt like a moment I've seen in movies.
If I remember correctly, she pauses in the middle of the hallway and is kind of centered.
It's the way it's done. It's like I understand she's saving her life. I completely get it. I understand the full circle of it. It makes perfect sense. I completely get it. It was the only moment in the movie where I thought that I was watching a movie, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then the moment that scene cuts and then they continue on into the Offerman sequence, I was locked back in. So it was almost like, it was almost as if someone tapped me on my shoulder.
Sure.
Said, "Hey man, you're in a movie." And then I forgot they were there. That was the only problem I had with it.
Yeah. I didn't have that reaction. Kind of the opposite. I really loved that. I felt like the movie was building up to earn a cinematic moment. And to me, I just love the setup and payoffs of this film. When Kaylee's character asks her, "If I had gotten shot, would you have taken my picture?" And she says, "What do you think?" And that is her in the moment. She took the picture. She is now a wartime journalist, and she literally stands up and crosses the threshold.
But you can still do that
image. No.
I
get that taste wise, you want it differently. I'm saying for me, I felt it earned a cinematic moment that felt like it was staged because it was the culmination of these characters and the emotion of it. For me, it earned it. And I loved it. I loved it.
It was just the moment where I felt like they put the bumpers up. That was the only thing. And then someone came by and cleared them back off again. And then we were back into the dangerous. Like, the movie just never felt Hollywood or melodramatic to me until that scene. Like,
yeah, I just genuinely impressed. Read it that way. Yeah.
Also, plus you guys had the ability to think anything in that moment because I just couldn't breathe.
It was intense.
Holding on for as much as I could.
Can we also just real quick mention the scene where Kaylee is crawling on those bodies?
Oh, because is that the Plemons scene?
Plemons scene. Yeah, so the end of
is that
it.
The Plemons scene?
Yeah, there's Holy a sequence. God. So we talk about this a little bit in non-spoiler territory, but the Plemons sequence obviously is a very extreme scene. It's very long. It's very, very disturbing. The climax of that scene is incredible.
Yeah, like I'm dying to know who the other actor was, by the way. No offense to anyone, like not even like in a I just am curious to know.
Yeah.
I just want to know what else it could have looked like because he is so good.
I know.
And it's such a Plemons.
And like, it's like if you're casting that part, you'd get Jesse Plemons.
Right. So, so how different did he make it, if at all? Right. Like I'm dying to know who that actor was. And I think he said it was a big actor. I think he said it was another big actor and something came up, I think. But
I bet you those red glasses were Plemons' choice.
Probably.
I feel like he would pick something like that because it was so out there.
His line, I think, is the most uncomfortable in the film, which is, what kind of American are you?
Yeah.
That is such a uncomfortable gut punch of a mentality that I fear too many people have. Yeah. You know, like that's a question that would get asked. That's a question that to me feels too close to reality.
Oh, yeah.
Where sometimes this movie veers. It's not afraid to veer too close and to show a reflection in the mirror of, hey, you probably know somebody who would ask this question. And it's like, oh, right. God,
yeah,
that's so true. And I hate that. God,
incredibly staged.
Forgive my ignorance on this. What was the name? Who's the name of the actor who's in Dune?
Stephen McKinley Henderson. Yeah, he's fantastic. I was going to say we hadn't brought him up yet. I wanted to. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yes. Like my favorite, probably my,
he's the
my
rock
favorite
of that group. Yeah.
He, 100%. That character is so important. And I guess because we're in spoilers, just the way he ends that Plemons scene is just so insane. Like the way he did that sequence. And I just didn't see that coming. It was shocking. But that character, I agree with you, Gabe. He is the rock of the movie. He's kind of, I want to mention one more thing on the drive down. And we talk about this on the show a lot, about how exposition can be done really well and how exposition can be done poorly.
Are you talking about
when
they ask the questions?
Yes.
I thought the same. I thought of you when I heard it. I said, that's how you do it. That's how you do it.
Genuinely genius exposition. Yeah, because
I literally thought of you when I saw it. I was like, this is great. And I think Kevin's going to like it.
Because there's what we're referring to, and this is actually in the trailer too, like the character is in the back seat, basically grilling Wagner and
he's doing a nerd out.
Yeah. And they're basically, he's saying, what are you going to ask the president? And in this scene, they tell you the entirety of what's going on in a way that is like, it's so smart. Like I always think of I mentioned this in the show before, like in Terminator 2, when they're walking to Linda Hamilton's cell in the hospital, they have an entire scene where they explain the plot of T1 on the way there because it makes sense to tell the people that are walking there what happened.
That's a good example of kind of the caliber of Alex Garland in general.
Yes.
But the writing and the way that this
smart.
Think about the other version of this movie is it opens with an explanation of how America got to this point.
In text, like here's what happened.
A montage of like, this is what
news footage.
And instead it does that. It trickles information to you. You already understand how this could happen. Go ahead.
But Kev, it didn't bother you when Randall Park showed up and he said, back up, Jimmy.
was that WandaVision?
WandaVision.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Jimmy.
We've been joking on that for so long because it's like, let me re-explain everything that happened in the MCU.
We should close out spoilers and continue to move on before we lose Sean. I want you guys to discuss this as well. If you have thoughts, it's really hard to end a movie like this. Like I can't imagine trying to get to a conclusion. And I thought that the setup and payoff of wait and him saying, I need a quote. And he says, please don't kill me. And I think he says that'll do. And like, that's such a great payoff to leave us on. It was so good.
So I asked Garland, at what point did he figure out what his ending was going to be, because it's the kind of movie where, and Kevin has been saying this, without guardrails, I literally had no clue where we were going to go to, like what 100%. Was waiting for us at the end of the story. And what blows my mind is that Garland said that he actually started with the last 5 minutes of the movie.
Oh, wow.
And knew that that's where he was going to end. And then just for dramatic exercise, backfilled the rest of the movie.
Speaking of Stephen McKinley Henderson, he's the one who delivers the line of he'll disappoint you. Like they always end up being weaker men than you think or whatever. I forget exactly his quote, but he sets up that happening. It's so good.
Is tremendous. The reason why Stephen isn't in Dune 2 is because he did this?
No, because I think he shot stuff for Dune 2 and it got cut. I think I read a story recently that he had footage or scenes that were shot and he was disappointed that they didn't make it into the final cut.
He's one of my favorite people in Dune 1 because the eyes go back. It's so cool how they right, because his character's like eyes go backwards, right, in Dune 1, yeah, right, yeah, Digga? But like, it's yeah, really
he's
cool.
He's a Mentat. Yeah, they kind of have they're basically human computers. Like they.
It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's throw it to a really quick break and we'll be back on the other side with some more Riverland. And we are back. So I do want to briefly mention the fact that I am in Las Vegas and I'm at CinemaCon 2024. We talk about this around this time every single year. It's a convention where the major studios come and they each put on different presentations teasing for the theatrical exhibitors the big movies are going to be coming to their theaters at the end of from now to the end of the year to get them super excited about the product that's coming. And as journalists, we come and we cover and get to see a lot of early footage for films that are coming in 2024. This year, they're even showing off a lot of things that are coming in 2025.
Oh, wow.
Because I'm really starting to understand how A, COVID still to this day, and B, the strikes have wreaked havoc on the studios. Release schedules. Like, we are seeing footage from things that Ballerina in particular, and I'll talk about this. So Lionsgate was today, the day that we're recording, and Ballerina is this John Wick spinoff that has Ana de Armas in it. They filmed that movie back in 2021.
Jesus. And
they've just been waiting for the right time to put it out. And now, because they have waited as long as they have, and the story, which I didn't know this beforehand, is set between John Wick 3 and John Wick 4. Keanu Reeves is in this movie. Like, the character is still in the movie. But what they said was, because it's not coming out until 2025 now, Len Wiseman came up with, the director came up with new set pieces and sequences that they are now going back to film over the course of this year to keep improving the movie. Like, this movie that should have come out a while ago is still being added to. And Lionsgate came off of John Wick 4, The Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Is
that, mm-hmm, that sounds right. Yeah.
And Saw 10. Like, those are their three benchmark franchises, as they say. And they are going to continue to lead into all of them. Like, they now consider those are the stories that they want to keep growing with. But in addition to that, Lionsgate announced a ton of really exciting things that I wasn't aware of. Henry Cavill is in The Highlander, and that's with Chad Stahelski. They talked about that. Cavill came out on screen. He teased the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, but then also dropped a trailer for another Guy Ritchie movie that's coming in January. That's done already. It's called In the Gray. And it's Cavill, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Issa Gonzalez as three sexy criminals who have to steal money around the globe. And it couldn't be more charming. Like, it looks like the three of them just cranking their charisma up in a Guy Ritchie movie. So I had no idea that was even coming, and it looks great. Ruben Fleischer is doing Now You Three Me. And that entire cast is coming back.
Is it called?
It's not called that, is it?
I think it is. I think it's called Now You Three Me.
Movie of the year.
That's a really bad title. Bad title.
Well, all they said was the Now You See Me cast is returning for a third movie. But honestly, if they don't call it Now You Three Me, then what are we even doing here?
I mean, it's funny, but like, you can't do that. Like, seriously. Well,
Kev, what do you think? You think the fans of Now You See Me 1 and 2 are going to be confused about that not being the third installment, the story franchise?
Well, they just call it a missed opportunity.
I'm seen. I don't know.
Again, they missed out on the two-hander of Now You See Me and the sequel being Now You Don't. I mean, it's...
Yeah, you don't.
That would have been brilliant.
They missed the title game a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's see. In addition to... So Lionsgate also had Borderlands... And The Crow, they had an extended look at The Crow.
How's that look? Which I thought I want it to be good. I'm hoping
Skarsgård.
I thought it looked so. There's an initial trailer that came out for The Crow that I wasn't incredibly impressed by. And then this one was the red band, hard R, like, holy shit, this is going to be super gory.
That's cool.
Version. And I am now way more on board with what this is going to be. And people who don't know the story, it's Skarsgård falls in love with this girl that he meets in looks like a rehab facility kind of thing. And then the two of them are murdered. And then he becomes this angel of vengeance kind of thing. And can only stay alive as long as he's still on a mission to kill all the people who are responsible for it. So Lionsgate seems to be trading in the John Wick, you know, vengeance missions type of sure. thing. And this fits really well into that. Then there was a really weird movie that looks really bad called Flight Risk. And it's directed by Mel Gibson. And it stars Mark Wahlberg. And it's set on a charter plane where Mark Wahlberg has to fly Topher Grace, who is like a convicted criminal, to New York City for a trial. And in the midst of the flight, shenanigans occur. Mark Wahlberg, sort of, but yeah.
Not, but it's like but, a small, it's, I'm reading, it's like a small plane. It's not like a,
it is. Yeah, it's Con Air Wahlberg felt like a, and the girl and then the criminal.
Yeah.
But it just, at some point it's revealed there's a twist about Mark Wahlberg's character. I don't want to give it away. And he is doing a Southern accent and has this really bad balding hairpiece. I don't know. It seems like a couple of choices were made on Flight Risk. So
I'll be take curious Mark to see Wahlberg if that makes going the all in on something.
Yeah, I guess we'll wait and see how that's that fun. Plays out. Prior to that, we got a chance to see The Fall Guy. That was the opening night movie, which I thought was fun. And then they had the Warner Brothers panel, which had extended look at Furiosa and the Joker trailer.
How did Furiosa look?
Yeah, for you especially. So,
I mean, to me, it looks like an extension of the world that exists in Fury Road. The biggest difference, I think, from it is that it's going to cover a longer time period than any of the Mad Max movies has done. I think George Miller said it's going to be 16 to 18 years in Furiosa's life. So when you watch the trailer and you see those snippets of her as a little girl, there's a lot more of that. Because they sort of showed us this extended preview and it was broken into three chapters. And the first chapter, which could be a pretty long time, was her and her mother in the Green Place and their relationship and how much of a badass her mom is as a character. And then Furiosa gets abducted by the forces that are led by Chris Hemsworth's character. They're kind of vague in terms of why they are abducting her. But then the second chapter, which is about like her getting this heroic phase is her kind of learning to be a badass, but that's still a young Anya Taylor-Joy. And then the third bit is very much like her mom says to her, like, no matter what happens, you have to promise me you're always going to try to get back home to where we live in the Green Place. And then that sort of begins with where she shaves her head and gets the metallic arm. So it seems like you're going to get a lot of movie before you get to that kind of thing, and then even more movie beyond it. So I think in scope, the story looks to be more extensive than what I thought they offered in Fury Road. But the tone and the style and the type of action is still very much, you know, what he did with the Mad Max.
I want to know what it was like. So obviously at this point, people have probably seen the Joker 2 trailer. Yeah. But there's a shot at the end of the film that Lawrence Shear, obviously DP on the first Joker, and now this, that I think is brilliant. And for people who obviously have seen it, it's a lipstick smile, but there's also a focus pulling in that sequence that it's just mind blowing how they line that up. I just want to know what it was like in the room when that scene hit, because the whole trailer is great, but that moment in particular is
absolutely insane. It feels like it played out in slow motion.
Yeah.
Because she draws it and your mind goes, and she says something like, I want to see the real you, or I want to see you who you really are. I forget, I'm paraphrasing. And then he moves his face and you're in your chair. You talk about this a lot. You know, sometimes you kind of move to get a better look at the angle.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is this going to line up? And when it clicks in, the room was like, like no one could believe that they saw it match up well as it matched up.
Do you?
It was crazy.
Maybe they've said this, and I don't think that they would between the two of them, Phillips and Schur. But it's not impossible to do that digitally. How disappointed would you be if it's
I don't think it's digital.
I don't think it would be, but
I'd be upset.
But you could make it look that good digitally.
I know you could. You could do it. You know what? If we get Todd Phillips, we're asking him about that scene.
And then Kevin walks out.
What if he says if we had to do it digitally? He's like, we tried it a couple of times. We just couldn't get it.
That moment.
Nolan runs in the room and tackles Todd Phillips immediately. He says, I did a explosion of an atomic bomb in Oppenheimer and you guys couldn't do a lipstick lineup. Come on.
Imagine Joaquin's face. So great.
Felt like a tease for like comic book fans. Like it's going to be the thing where that ended like a traditional superhero trailer where it's like, we're going to get the guy at the end of it. Or like, they're going to get their suit. You know, it had that kind of feeling. And in the movie, it's just going to be a great shot. in a moment. You know?
Yeah, that's true. Such a good shot.
The one thing that bothers me about the Joker trailer is having Harley be a fellow patient. Because she's supposed to be a doctor. I mean, traditionally in her origin story, she's a doctor. You know, who sort of falls for him,
right, or something like that.
Yeah. People are not critiquing, but what they're saying about Joaquin's Joker is that they can't really see him becoming the criminal mastermind that he's supposed to be. And I mean, I know that we're reading too deeply into. I think Todd Phillips is trying to do more of a mood movie than he is like, I'm building the blocks to this being the criminal mastermind.
This is ever a universe that sees a masked vigilante or criminal in a purple suit. I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I get that. But then like he bothered to do the Batman origin, you know, he bothered to do the Wayne's getting shot in the alley. So it's like, why do you do it unless you're building towards? And I mean, I don't think they ever think they're going to do multiple movies. I think they're just playing in the sandbox for the
were like not keen on a sequel at the end of the first one. So
he said from the stage at this presentation that he admitted, he was like, even though when I was doing press, I said, didn't think of this as a sequel. Joaquin and I, when we were on set for the first movie, were trading ideas already. If this connects, you know, where should we go with this sort of thing? And as for Gaga, how she got involved, it was simply because Todd Phillips was producer on Star Is Born.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sean, like, did you get to see the scene where Ezra Miller's Flash pops in through the through time and space during the musical number?
What about the Zack Snyder cameo?
Yes.
He's like, release the Phillips cut.
Ezra catching babies left and right in the background. All right. We got to wrap. But here's what I would like you guys to weigh in the comments down below. I sort of touched on this when I was discussing Civil War, and I kind of want to get a temperature check for where people in the audience are right now as the movie is planning to open. I've heard from enough people that say the trailers have scared them off of the movie or just presented the film as something that they probably don't want to sit through. I totally understand, you know, movie going is an exercise that people go, a lot of times they want to go for an escape. You know, they don't necessarily want to be challenged or have their buttons pushed or anything like that. But I'm genuinely curious how people feel having seen the reactions to the movie and some of the reviews that are dropping it. And maybe you listen to Alex Garland's interview on our show and it potentially changed your mind. I want to know, just let us know in the comments down below how you feel going into the weekend about Civil War. You're definitely giving it a shot. Is it something you're still hesitant about going to see? Let us know if maybe our comments sort of turned you over. I think next week we're definitely going to be talking about the box office for it. I'm genuinely curious to see how people respond to the film. And hopefully it's a film that we continue to talk about over the rest of the year as we get into, obviously, awards. But God, that's months, almost a full year away from this at this point. So we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Thank you guys so much for tuning into this new episode of Real Blend. You can follow us online at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show itself is at Real Blend. Until next week.
Dunkirk.
I feel like I was supposed to have something. Yeah, we had something.
Come on, who do we need this year? Who's got a big release this year?
Sean Levy.
Sure.
Sean Levy, friend of the show.
Two-time guest or just once?
Two-time guest. Let's make it three. Deadpool 3.
There we go.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.